We are going to deal with an important topic discussed in the devotion classic of Bhagavata. Bhagavata is a devotion classic written around 8th century AD. Some of its original forms existed even in 2nd century BC, but this work took its present form around 8th or 9th century AD. That is the view of historians and scholars. Now, the topic is a spiritual dialogue from the Bhagavata Purana. There are many spiritual dialogues in Bhagavata Purana. This particular dialogue is between a great king, a great emperor. His name was Nimi, and 9 great sages who visited him once. Now, I shall give you some background. In ancient times, sometimes emperors and kings and princes used to renounce their kingdom and go into forests in search of spiritual teachers and discuss with them philosophical, spiritual, metaphysical topics. Sometimes great men of wisdom, saints and sages and philosophers, used to visit the kings and emperors in their palaces and discuss spiritual, philosophical topics. In this particular episode, the conversation is between 9 sages who visit this king, this emperor, namely King Nimi, in his palace. And when they arrived, the king received them with great reverence and respect, and then he puts 9 questions, important questions related to spiritual and metaphysical topics, and these 9 sages give their answers. In the verse, you will find one verse in that chapter. I can refer to this. You can see. You find 21st verse if you take. That verse, the second chapter, 11th skantha. 11th skantha is a book, you mean, section of a work. It's called skantha. In Bhagavata, there are total 12 skandhas, 12 sections. Each section will have several chapters. And each chapter will consist of several verses. So, this particular episode is discussed in the 11th skandha, 11th book. In the second chapter, this one verse, 21st verse. So there you find Kavir Harir Antariksha Prabuddha Pippalayanaha Avi Hotroda Drumilas Chamasa Karabhajanaha. These are the 9 sages. Their names are given here. Kavihi is one. Kavi is the name of one sage. Harihi, another one. Then Antariksha, the third sage. Fourth one is Prabuddha. Fifth one, Pippalayana. The sixth, Avirhotraha. The seventh is Drumilaha. The eighth, Chamasaha. And the ninth, Karabhajanaha. These 9 great sages are visiting the great king, Nimi. He was the king of the kingdom of Janaka, roughly speaking, in today's Bihar state of India, the place not far from the holy spot where Buddha got his illumination, the same state, Buddha Gaya and all. Now, when they arrived, it is now you can, I shall refer to some of the verses when we go into detailed discussion. At that time, we'll discuss. Now, You see, 28th verse, this is very important, though it is not directly related to the episode. In this 28th verse, se manye bhagavata sakshat parshadanvo madudvishaha vishnu bhutani lokanam pavanaya charantihi. This verse is very important, but it gives you a glimpse into the spiritual culture of those days. Now, the king tells these sages, I look upon you as the embodiment of divinity itself. I look upon you, addressing the sages, the king says, I look upon you as the walking embodiments of divinity itself. Great saints and sages like you wander about the world. You are roaming about the world to help people like me, to find out people like me who are sincere seekers, to give a helping hand to us. So, in those days, great saints and sages used to travel all over India. And whenever and wherever somebody is turning to spirituality, turning to spiritual quest, they would go there and give them instruction. This was the common practice. So the king tells them, I consider myself to be blessed in having got this opportunity to see you, because people like you, the next verse he says, people like you are walking about, they're roaming about this countryside with the noble intention of giving a helping hand to spiritual seekers like me. That's significant, because it gives a glimpse into the culture, the spiritual tradition of those days. It is important to keep this in mind, to appreciate and enjoy this episode. Now, in the 30th verse, the king asked the question. The question is this. I shall first explain in English what the question is. Please teach me what is good for humanity. That's the idea behind. Please teach me what will be auspicious, useful, helpful to me in my spiritual journey. Ata atyantikam kshemam. Say, one word is used, atyantikam kshemam means ultimate good, ultimate auspiciousness. Anything which gives you peace and tranquility, not temporarily, for eternity. Now, any material or empirical gain also gives you a degree of happiness or satisfaction. But that is not eternal. Because what gives you satisfaction vanishes one day. So, before you got it, we were dissatisfied. And when we get it, we are anxious not to lose it. So, at that time also, we are not actually enjoying. And then when we lose it, then of course it is lost. So, Bhagavata in another context says, any material gain is misery before you get it, and misery when you have got it, and misery of course when you have lost it. So, this verse uses one word, the meaning is atyantikam kshema, means ultimate good. You gain something which will never be lost, which will be eternal, which will not just make you satisfied, which make you contented. This contentment is much higher than satisfaction. Satisfaction is the feeling, well, I am fine. You get something, but then it will be lost. Now, contentment is a feeling that you get, well, I have got something. There is nothing beyond this that I can look for, that I can, that I should seek. That feeling is called, is used, is meant by a particular phrase here, atyantikam kshemam. Atyantikam means ultimate, eternal, something that gives you a sense of eternal peace and tranquility, a feeling, well, I have got something, there is nothing beyond this that I must search for. That is called, in fact, that is what everyone is looking for. People are knocking at the wrong doors, that's all. They are knocking at the wrong, when people try to acquire this ultimate eternal contentment through money, they think that money will give them eternal peace, because this is the subject of the eternal quest of humanity, this ultimate good. But they do not realize that what they are trying to get will not give them ultimate or eternal contentment. It will only give them temporary satisfaction. That they do not realize, or they realize only too late. So here, the king tells the sages, I want to ask you about something which will make me contented for all life. Because then he says, samsares bin kshanardhopi satsanga shevadhir nranam. Meaning is this, in this world, samsara actually, you know, it has got a much deeper meaning. Samsara actually implies this eternal wheel of, this rotating wheel of birth, death and rebirth. That's the meaning of samsara. Samsara actually means a kind of, it implies a flow, continuous flow of life activities for fulfilling different desires, death and rebirth, and continuing this rotation of wheel of existence. That is samsara. Now, in this samsara, even for 1 second, for a few minutes, if we can get holy company to discuss spiritual ideas, it is a great benefit. It is a great treasure. Actually, the word is used as sevatihi, means treasure. The Sanskrit term has got some, you know, the Sanskrit language, as in classical Hebrew, Latin and all that, they've got certain deep-rooted implications. So here samsara doesn't mean this world, though the superficial meaning could mean this world. But actually samsara means this endless game of being born, enjoying and suffering, dying and again being reborn. And also it implies the idea that what we have got right now is a state of imperfection. There is a higher state that we are trying to achieve, that we are seeking. And we have already had this in the past. But then, due to some undesirable karmas, we got the present state. We had to get back, we had to regain our lost spiritual kingdom, in other words. That is the implication of samsara, because a wheel is wheel. You know. To get out of this wheel is a supreme goal of human existence. For that, the easiest path is to meet somebody and to discuss with them and to get from them some positive spiritual ideas that will help us to turn a new leaf in our life, to open a new chapter in our life. All these implications are to be understood here, samsara. So, sevadhi means treasure. What is a treasure? The treasure is getting out of this wheel of this eternal samsara, empirical existence, which is full of empirical enjoyments and empirical miseries, both temporary. So, and for this, he asked a question. Please teach me that spiritual wisdom which will help me to get out of this samsara? This is the first question which he puts. And in answer to this question, the sage says that you can find in the 36th verse of second chapter, a very famous verse. This verse is chanted by countless devotees, millions of devotees, every day in the morning. A very, very famous verse. It actually means this: by word, by deed, by thought, by all our actions, actions with mind, actions with vocal cords, or any kind of, every minute of our existence, and every act should be turned into an offering to God. This is the implication here. That's the essence of here. So, the sage says, the first question is answered by the first sage, Kavihi. Because in the list of nine sages, the first one is Kavi, the Kavir Harir Antariksha Prabuddha Pippalayanaka. So, the first sage is Kavihi. So, he says, the easiest path is this. Whatever you do with body, with mind, with word, with senses, with intellect, and also our time and energy, because we live and we function, we work in this canvas of time and energy. All days should be an offering to God. Look upon our entire existence, all our activities as an offering to God. This is the best and easiest way to get out of this wheel of empirical existence. The verse is famous. Kayena. Kayena actually means by body. Vacha means by word. Manasa means by mind. Indriya means by different senses of action and senses of perception. And then buddhi actually means intellect. Then our own action. And then anusudha sabhava. Anusudha sabhava actually means our natural impulses. See, the verse is very, very profound. What we do with our body now is perhaps a conscious act. What we speak also, and what we think to a lesser extent, a conscious action. What we feel. So, body, mind, intellect, word, etc. But there is another important point, anusudha sabhava. Anusudha actually means, you know, again it refers to pravaha, means flow. See, whatever we have accumulated, whatever accumulated tendencies, impressions and characteristics that we have accumulated in our mind, these tendencies and impressions constitute what is called our innate nature, which is called svabhava. There are certain things that we can't do, we cannot help doing in a given manner. See, there are certain characteristics and certain behavior patterns which we can't help following. Certain inherent characteristics of doing certain things or not doing certain things. It may be thinking, it may be speaking, it may be acting. There are certain things that we can't help doing in a particular way. See, Swami Vivekananda in his Karma Yoga lectures, he refers to this idea. So he says, we are good because we can't help it. We are bad because we can't help it. It doesn't mean that we are helpless in the almighty hands of destiny or fate. No, no. The point is this. We have inherited certain innate, inherent characteristics. And they drive us in a particular way. We have no choice in the matter. These impulses and characteristics are implied by this word anusruta swabhava in Sanskrit. It's a technical term. So here the first sage says, whatever we do, conscious action or unconscious action, conscious action like physical activities, speaking, and unconscious action, though it may not be in our hands, but still, if we mentally offer all this to God, then whatever we do gets sublimated. So a work which is done as a work becomes a worship if the attitude behind the work is changed. Make it an offering to God. Then in the most empirical work becomes worship. It could be the other way. Sometimes, you know, a worshipper will do his worship as work. That is the other end of it. So work can become a worship if our attitude changes. And then worship also can become a work if our attitude is negative. So here what the great sage says is this. Whatever we do with body, with word, with mind, means thoughts. So kayena vacha manasendriyaiva. So kayena means through by body, vacha means by word, what we speak, manasa means what thought flashes in our mind. We have no control over that. And then indriya actually means senses, senses of perception, senses of action, and intellect. And also by inherent tendencies, built-in characteristics. Whatever we do, we pray to God to accept this as an offering. Then what happens? Whole human life becomes a sacrifice. Our whole human existence becomes a worship, becomes a spiritual practice. This is possible even for those who do not believe in God. Because the best way to convert action into karma yoga is by adding action with non-attachment. If you remove attachment from our action, then action becomes a worship. This is possible for all. You need not even believe in a particular God. Of course, for those who believe in God, this becomes natural, easy, very easy. But even if you don't believe in God, if you remove the selfish desire, selfish motives from our actions, then these actions become an offering to God. Swami Vivekananda says, you know, he once says, the best offering to God is the service done to the man living next door to you. It is in the practical Vedanta, Swami Vivekananda says. All these ideas are taken from a great text of ancient times. So this is the first question, first answer. What should we do to live in this world and practice spirituality? Living in this world, not going away from this world, it is possible for people belonging to all walks of life. You need not go into forests. Though the sage mentioned earlier that holy company is the easiest way to practice, to imbibe spiritual values. That was an instruction given earlier. But then, while elaborating this subject, the great sage says, this is one way to practice this in daily life. Whatever we do with bodily actions, whatever words we speak, and whatever thoughts we think, and whatever ideas we cognize with the intellect, and whatever may be our actions, over which we have no control, because there are certain inherent characteristics which are not within our control. Only after doing that we feel, oh, I have done this. But if we always keep in mind that whatever I do is an offering to God, then all these actions become an offering. Not only that, a person who has sincerely surrendered his actions and the results of his actions to God cannot do anything evil. It becomes physically and psychologically impossible for such a spiritual seeker to do anything evil. So this is the first question, this is the first answer. Now I will go to the next question, because we have 9 questions and 9 answers. And from 11 to 11:30 we will have interaction. If there is any point to be discussed further, we will discuss at that time. And even if you feel that certain ideas are not at all clear to you at the time of the class, then you can raise, I shall repeat the idea again. Now the next question. The king continues his dialogue. Of course, you know, the first sage, after answering the first question, he elaborates his subjects. There is a long, elaborate discussion based on the first answer. But we don't have time to go through all those details. Now the next question. You can come to 2nd chapter 44th verse. There you find the king asked the second question. This is a very important question from a philosophical and spiritual point of view. Because there are 3 important verses which are which are very important, which are very crucial in understanding the second answer. Now here in the 44th verse, the king asks the question, Atha Bhagavatam Bruta Yad Dharmo Yadrisho Nranam Yad Acharidi Yad Bruti Yerlingehi Bhagavat Priyaka. Now he asks the question, now you told me that the best way to practice spirituality in this world is to make an offering of all our activities, bodily activities, actions, then verbal activities, words that we speak, mental activities, thoughts and impulses, and even inherent characteristics. This was the answer that you gave. Now, I would like to know the characteristics of a devotee, of an ideal spiritual seeker who has attained this level of spiritual evolution. That is the question. Please explain to me the characteristics, the behavior patterns, and the attitudes of an ideal devotee, of a really enlightened spiritual seeker who has surrendered his whole existence to God, who has spiritualized his whole life. What are his characteristics, and how do we distinguish them when we see in a crowd? Of course, in a crowd we cannot understand, but what are the distinguishing marks and characteristics of such a great spiritual seeker? This is the second question. You find the 44th verse. Now, in answer to this question, the second sage is Hari, the second sage. He gives a picture of 3 levels of spiritual evolution. He gives the picture of a devotee of the highest spiritual development, a highly evolved spiritual devotee. And then there are those who have not so well evolved. And then there are those who belong to a lower level. Now, if you read this verse, you will understand there are 2 levels of evolution. evolution taking place at the level of the seeker and evolution taking place at the level of the sought. See, a highly evolved spiritual seeker will have a sublime concept of ultimate reality. He would think of God as an all-pervading reality, all-encompassing reality, who is present everywhere, who is omnipresent, all-pervading, who is immanent, and who is transcendental. But a primitive spiritual seeker will think, well, my God sitting in my temple is the right God. All others are all demigods or maybe not even gods at all. Now, between these two, there are those who belong to the intermediate level. So, two types of evolutions are hinted at here. The first verse is 45th verse when Sarva Bhudeshuya Pasyet Bhagavad Bhava Matmanaha Bhudani Bhagavadi Atmani Esha Bhagavatottamaha. See, 45th verse. Here, you can get the picture of a highly evolved spiritual seeker. What we call a liberated person, or a knower of Brahman, or a mystic. You can use that. Those spiritual seekers who have gone beyond the formalities of conventional religious practices. Those who can see God not only in a temple or a church, but those who feel the presence of God, not just feel, who experience the presence of God in everything in this world. That is the picture of the highest spiritual seeker. He's not a seeker, he has already reached his goal. That picture is clearly drawn in the 45th verse. Sarva Bhudeshuya Pasyet. He sees the same divine reality in all living beings. See, Buddha actually means anything which has come into existence. Not only human beings or members of the animal kingdom, even trees and plants, because he can't see anything other than God in this world. So God is not just a creator God for him. God is a divine principle, which is all-pervading, which is immanent in every being and omnipresent. So, see, Yaha means the one who sees, who experiences the presence of the Lord in all beings. You should always remember, when we use the word God, please remember, in these texts, we do not mean a God who creates his world and stays away from his creation. This is a very important principle for us to understand. Here, of course, we use the word God because this is a theistic concept, you remember. There is the highest Advaitic or non-dualistic experience hinted at it. But the great sage Hari is here expounding the characteristics of the highest devotee of God, one who is dearest to God and one to whom God is the dearest. So that God is not a creator God who stays away from his creation. Rather, it is the divine principle that is present as the immanent principle in all living beings, and also as the omnipresent, all-pervading reality present everywhere, and also the ultimate transcendental reality. So he says in the 45th verse, the one who sees the presence of the Lord in all beings as non-different, non-distinct from himself, and who feels the presence of all beings in God. So you see, he sees God in all beings and he sees all beings in God. He feels the presence, he experiences, he sees the presence of the Lord in the entire creation. At the same time, he sees creation, the whole creation in God. So, this person is, the word used here is Bhagavata Uttamaha. Uttamaha means the highest. He is the highest devotee. There are three levels. You know, Uttama means the highest. Madhyama means middle level. Athama means lowest. So who is the highest devotee? In other words, the highest devotee is also the highest philosopher. Because at the experience level, philosophy and devotion merge into one, which is technically called mystical experience. That's the word used in the Western mystical tradition. But that implies practically the same thing. So, there is one point when the highest non-dualistic philosophy of jnanam or wisdom merges with the highest devotional experience. So, the Hari says, my dearest devotee, or the devotee who has reached the highest level of devotional evolution is the one who sees God everywhere and who sees nothing but God. There is nothing else to be seen for him, because there is nothing in this world which is distinct from God. Not that he sees the mic or this glass or the cloak as God, not in that way. There is nothing else in this world other than God as the ultimate reality. See, if you say, well, this glass has nothing to do with God, you have to admit God is one reality and this glass is another reality. So both are realities. In that case, the glass has got the same status of reality with God. So God is not absolute reality. So that's the idea behind. So the idea is this, the whole creation as its origin at God's will. In that sense, it is non-distinct, non-different from God. Now, even here, there are two levels of evolution. As you experience the divine principle within you, you become contented. You become enthroned. You become wise. But it has got another dimension. As you go deeper and deeper into yourself, you also farther and farther towards the external world, because you also sees you are able to see that the same immanent principle that is residing within you is the all-pervading reality in the external world. So what is immanent is also omnipresent. So there is a unity of experience. As we go deeper and deeper inward, we also go farther and farther outward. In the sense, as we realize the immanent principle within, you also realize the omnipresent reality without. Then you can't see anybody as distinct from you. You can't hate anyone. You might live in the world, but you won't have any kind of distinction, any kind of ill feeling towards anyone. So this is also, this highest sublime attitude is a natural characteristic of a devotee. If you read the Gita 12th chapter, you can find all this. The highest devotee is one who, while realizing the presence of the Lord within, also realizes the presence of the Lord as the all-pervading, omnipresent reality everywhere. So he becomes a great human being, and also he becomes a great seeker within. Those who are interested, if you read Bhagavad Gita 12th chapter, 8th verse. In Bhagavad Gita, if you go to 12th chapter, Bhakti Yoga, 8th verse, you find the same idea. There you find Mayeva mana athatsva mai buddhim niveshaya nivasi shasi mayeva ada urdham na samshaya. The meaning is this: the highest devotee is one who lives in me and in whom I live. That's the meaning here. The highest devotee who has dedicated his mind and intellect to me lives in me, and I also take my residence in his heart. That's the literal meaning of the 8th verse in the 12th chapter you find. So first, the sage gave a graphic description of the highest devotee, Bhagavadottamaha. Now, in our philosophical literature, you find at the highest experience level, the highest devotion and the highest wisdom, non-dualistic experience, are the same. Sri Ramakrishna says pure jnanam and pure bhakti are the same in his works. In fact, Shankaracharya, in his commentary on the Gita, there is a portion where he says, purest devotion, where you have unwavering devotion to God, will make you feel that that devotion is non-different from jnanam, means highest spiritual wisdom or non-dualistic experience. Sacha jnanam. The verse is this in the Gita chapter, the Lord, what Shankaracharya says is this: avibhijarini bhakti, or unwavering bhakti, nirmala, achala, shuddha, etc. He uses all these terms. That is jnanam, that is the highest knowledge itself. So devotion at the highest, purest and most sublime level is the same thing as the highest non-dualistic mystical experience. That's the idea implied in this 45th verse. Now, in the 46th verse, Hari comes down a few steps below and says, but this experience is not easy to reach. Before we have reached this experience, we should not try to practice spiritual socialism. It is very dangerous. If you try to look upon everyone as a Brahman, you are heading for a disaster. So, this is a very, very practical idea you find in the 46th verse. Here say, Ishwari tadadhineshu balisheshu dishutsucha prema maitri kripa upeksha yakarodi samadhyamaha. Madhyamaha actually means the middle level, not the highest nor the lowest. He says, now what about those who are spiritual pilgrims, who have just started the spiritual journey, nor who have not reached the highest mystical experience? We may read, this is a great danger in spiritual life, we may read a great mystical work. Intellectually, we may grasp this idea. And immediately, we would like to believe that we have reached that level. But this involves a great spiritual risk and danger. Because our intellect has grasped this great grand idea that the same divine principle is present everywhere, the same Brahman, Atman everywhere. So let us try to move with everyone. Then what happens, you know, our intellect has reached that level. Mind is far below. And we are all living at a mental level, not an intellectual level. All normal human beings are living at a mental level. When we read a book, when we grasp an idea, in a flash, we are dwelling at an intellectual level, idea level. But when we close the book and come down, that mental level again. And very often, there is a wide gap between these two levels. So very often, we forget this. And we try to impose upon ourselves the feeling. Nobody wants to consider himself to be a beginner. Everyone has got an inherent idea, and I belong to the highest type. Because if you don't want to be considered to be other than the best. So what really happens, we very often deceive ourselves, delude ourselves into the belief that what we have intellectually grasped, we have already experienced. This wrong idea is terribly dangerous. So, for the spiritual seekers, Hari, the second sage, gives a very practical suggestion. Well, you should have complete devotion to God. And then, you should be friendly. You should have an attitude of comradeship with those who are devotees of God. And then what about those who do not know anything about God? You should have sympathy, compassion, try to help them. But what about those who are very powerful, strong-willed people, but absolutely negative ideas? If you associate with them, you are gone, because they will convince you to their side. Because you have not reached the highest level, we are not able to convert them. But they are fully convinced of their materialistic or negative ideas. So their strong conviction will have an overbearing effect upon us. And they may even convert us. So what should we do? Keep a long distance. So that's why, Ishvara, towards God, you must have deep-rooted devotion. And towards his devotees, we must have an attitude of friendliness, comradeship. And towards those who do not know much about God, you should have compassion, sympathy. But those who hate God and those who are fully convinced of the most negative ideas, keep a long distance. If you try to convert them, they will convert you to their side. Sometimes it happens, you know, some people will tell you, well, in the beginning you may say, well, stealing is bad. And then there are some people, well, stealing is all right if it is most essential matter of survival. So the idea changes. And then stealing, well, there is, after all, you know, crimes are the creation of social evils. So stealing is perfectly all right. So slowly you find ideas change, ideas get diluted. So, negative ideas will have an overbearing effect on our mind. So, what happens? We must not hate them, because hatred also creates problems. Hatred also creates bondage, you know. It also creates an inner bondage. And extreme attachment also creates bondage. So, both we must avoid. So, upeksha means absolute indifference. Keep a long distance from them. Neither try to be very friendly with them, or try to, and don't go and quarrel with them. Then there is nothing else for you to do except quarreling with the bad people. So what we must do? Keep a long distance. So these are the four instructions given by Hari for those who have not reached the highest level of devotional spiritual evolution. Those who are still following the path, the track, who had not reached that goal. So, Ishvare tadadhineshu, baliseshu, dishutsucha, prema, maitri, kripa, upeksha, yekkaro, disamantimukha. These four recommendations, you know, prema means complete, unwavering devotion to God. Maitri means friendliness. You should be friendly with devotees of God, because that will help you in your spiritual life. Your convictions will be reinforced, your experiences will be enriched if you converse with devotees, fellow devotees of God. So, friendliness, interaction with fellow devotees of God is very helpful in spiritual life. And then, those who do not know, but they are good people, those who do not know anything about spiritual values, but they are interested to know, they are good people, you can help them. Compassion. But there are people who are hardened atheists, bohemians. So if you try to convert them before you have reached the highest goal, it is risky. So there is a story is told of Buddha. Buddha was an enlightened spiritual personality who have reached the highest goal. The same experience mentioned in the 45th verse, earlier verse. So one day Buddha was moving through forests, and then some fellow travelers came and warned him, "See, there is a great robber staying there. His name is Angulimala. He was a very violent person. His hobby was to kill people, rob them, and cut away their fingers and make a calendar. That was his hobby." Now many people warned him, "See, don't go that way, it's very risky." And Buddha didn't care and he continued walking. Now Angulimala came running after him, tried to chase Buddha, but could not reach him, because Buddha was a man of realization, he had many divine powers. So Angulimala tried his best to catch up with Buddha, but he couldn't do that. And then when Buddha just turned back and Angulimala saw him, he underwent a complete transformation. He became a great saint, he became a great Buddhist bhikshu later on. Now suppose a spiritual seeker who have not reached Buddhahood, the status of Buddha's spiritual illumination, if he tries to convert Angulimala, he will get a few more fingers, that's all. So this is given, this is explained in one of the Na Angulimala Buddha Buddhavat Parichara, in one of the Sanskrit tikas, sub super commentaries, and commentator writes, "Don't behave like Buddha before you become Buddha." So here in the 45th verse, a state of the highest spiritual illumination is described here. Before reaching that, if you feel that you are just spiritual seekers, then you must follow the instructions, the four instructions given in the 46th verse. So, Ishwarita Adhineshu, Balisheshu, Dishutsuja, Prema, Maitri, Kripa, Upeksha, Yakarodi, Samadhimaha. So, unwavering devotion to God, as I already explained, and a feeling of comradeship towards God's devotees, compassion or sympathy towards those who do not know about God but who would like to know about spiritual values, and complete indifference, a long distance from hardened atheists and hardened criminals. That these are the four instructions given to spiritual seekers in the 46th verse. If I got anything to be clarified, you can ask during interaction session. Now in the 47th verse, the great sage Hari comes down to the level of the lowest devotee. Prakritaha means the one who has just started his spiritual journey. Archayam eva hareye pujam yasraddhayekade natad bhakteshu cha anyeshu sa bhakta prakrita smritaha. This is the 47th verse. Here Hari says there are some devotees who belong to the lowest type, but they also have some interest in spiritual values, but they believe that if they go to a place of worship, do some rituals, that is the beginning and that's the end of spiritual life. They have no contact, they don't look upon other fellow human beings as even human beings. They believe that their spiritual practice begins with formal worship. You can say archa, archa or archana means formal worship. It also means mechanical rituals. If you pay fixed amount to the church or a temple or religious organization, or if you subscribe to a magazine, or if you go to a place of worship just once a month and do some formal mechanical ritual, and then you need not worry, God will be happy, you should not disturb me for the next 29 days, so I shall come again next day. Now, this kind of mechanical, formalistic worship, it is all right, but it is only the most primitive level of spiritual evolution. That's that implication of this verse. So the meaning is this, you shall read Archayam Eva Sadhaya Haraye Pujam Yaha Ihati Tadbhakteshu Anneshu Na Sabhakta Pragrata. This is the prose order. You know, Bhagavata is a very complicated and a bit complex work from literary point of view, grammatical point of view. So if you need, I can give the prose order and explanations, but that would take a long time. That's why I was avoiding that. Anywho, the 47th verse says this much. There are people who belong to the lowest, the most primitive level of spiritual or devotional evolution. They will be satisfied with pure mechanical rituals and formalistic worship. And not only that, they hate all others. Their devotion is confined to their own religion, their own particular denomination, their own particular temple, or their own particular place of worship. Beyond that, outside that, there is nothing. But God gives them also a small place in His empire, because they are better than other human beings who are not very different from animals. After all, they feel that this kind of formalistic mechanical worship makes some sense. But they do not realize that it is the most primitive step in spiritual evolution. So, Hari says, they natad bhakteshu channeshu. They do not recognize other devotees, the same God whom they worship. But they believe that their God is happy through this formalistic worship. Such people belong to the lowest primitive level, and they should slowly evolve further and further. This will explain in next class tomorrow. Now half an hour we'll have interaction. We can ask any question, what we have already discussed or what I have not discussed, that's for you. I try to clarify with my own capacity. Thank you. Oh, yes. Who you raised first? Okay, then after.
Swami, the answer to the first question, yes, was the whatever you have done through body, speech, that, and then you said that a person who really acts in that way is unable to do anything evil.
Yes.
Could you talk more about that?
Oh yes, you know, a person who sincerely surrendered his will to God will always remember God whenever he does any work. So that thought will be always associated with whatever action he does. I can give an example, a weird example from the life of Girishchandra Ghosh. He was a bohemian, you know. He was a bohemian, a dramatist actor. Now he was a drunkard. Sri Ramakrishna gave him many options, but ultimately, you know, that I need not go into details. Then Sri Ramakrishna took the power of attorney from him. Maybe this man didn't understand what it actually implied. Sri Ramakrishna did understand. But what happened? Later on, it became physically and psychologically impossible for him to do anything bad. In his life, he tried to drink. Suddenly he found in the glass the picture of Sri Ramakrishna. Which I mean the mental image, you know, because he suddenly remembered, I have given word, promise to that old priest, so I should not do anything that will hurt him. He had sincere devotion to Sri Ramakrishna, though he did not really understand his spiritual implication. But that act, because he was a sincere man, had a profound effect on his later life. It became physically and psychologically impossible for him to do anything bad, and he became a saint. But that's, in fact, that is the real principle behind the concept of confession in Catholic religion. So Augustine defines confession in Confessions in City of God, we find. So according to the original idea of confession, if you really confess to God, then from Monday onwards you can't behave what you like. It is not a renewal of license, actually. Actually, real confession implies a complete real inner transformation, according to Augustine. Otherwise, that confession becomes a mechanical ritual. So this idea is hindered at many other concepts like saranagati, meaning total surrender. I already explained this on many occasions. A person who really surrenders to God cannot do anything evil because he will not forget that he has surrendered. So that memory will act as an obstacle whenever he tries to do anything evil. That's how mind works. I think it's clear.
Thank you.
Any other? You use it.
Yes, sir. So in that same verse where the sage Kavi describes kindness to messenger, so everything that is done through body, mind, speech, do it as an offering to the Lord is the solution he gives. But our buddhi is most of the time it's in a manda state for some reason. How to first of all remember to do that? Because we remember a little bit, come, we listen, and then we go off to our works and offices, and then we forget, some type of covering comes, and you forget, and you go on. And then you come to a Sunday lecture, and then we remember, it is great, we have scripture class and Sunday lectures to refresh us. How to remember it always while you are doing it?
No, if we intensify this, this ideal of surrender to make to strengthen the memory so that it registers very strongly with great intensity in the mind, then we will not forget. See, in Girishendra Ghosh there are two factors. One was it was Sridharmakrishna to whom he surrendered. Second factor was this man, in spite of all his undesirable characteristics, he had one great quality. He was a man of strong integrity. When Sri Ramakrishna asked him, could you take God's name once? He said, no, I can't do it. I don't know when I'm going to get up. Now, any ordinary man of lesser integrity, all right, tomorrow I will do. And it had no effect on him. So generally, these things do not have any effect on the seeker because the seeker himself is not very serious. But in Girishendra Ghosh's case, he had many other vices, but he was a man of strong integrity. The very fact that he said, I can't take God's name the morning and evening because I don't know when I'm going to sleep, I don't know when I'm going to get up. Because he will be intoxicated. So how can such a man give word? But he didn't pretend to be a teetotaler. He said that is his condition. So that integrity, that sincerity, that worked a miracle in his life. So, in fact, the strength, the force with which this surrender registers in our mind is in direct proportion to our own sense of integrity and honesty. One story, perhaps I told some time back, there was an evangelist, a Catholic evangelist in India, who worked in central provinces before independence, before 1947. He was the one who said, poor Gandhi, he is such a good man, but he will go to hell. That was the kind of religion he practiced. But he was a good man, a very sincere, honest man in his own convictions. So what happened to him? I read his life. Now what happened to him? He fell sick. He had some serious malaria and all that. And he thought of going back to England. England or European countries. He was European. But then what happened? One day, for many days he prayed, but it didn't work. So he had even booked his ticket from Bombay to Southampton. Then one whole night he tried. Then he said, well, God, I prayed to you so many times and for so long. Now I won't even pray to you. I close my bargain here. From that moment onwards, he started recovering. That is the story goes. And he continued working in India for another 12 or 15 years. So, a sincere seeker, even in spite of his narrow-minded views, if he's a sincere seeker, that sincerity will take him to God. Sri Ramakrishna is Vyakulata, that term Sri Ramakrishna uses. That means integrity, honesty, sincerity, all put together is called. So, Girishendra Ghosh was a man of tremendous integrity. Sri Ramakrishna caught hold of that and transformed him. That's the idea behind.
I have this question, Maharaj. We talked about Anusandha Pravaha.
Anusrita Subhava. Yes.
So the tendency is we have in the cycle. You know, we have karma, theory of karma, we have to reach that point. But in the world we confront so many things, and we are compelled, or at least we make some let's say choices or react, and then later on we regret because we know this is not correct. The person with whom I talk to, yes, he is also the same karma I am trying to do. Maybe I have done a little better, but then this conflict will always be there when we meet in the world. So how do we get out of that?
Well, no. Anusudha Subhava, as I said, accumulated inherent drives and tendencies. But if we make an offering of all these to God in all sincerity, then that thought will accompany all our actions. Whether we remember that, we can never forget it. As I said, the integrity, the intensity with which we do this act of surrendering, making an offering to God, that will always remember. That will be always as a guiding light behind and along with every action that we do. That's why we should try to intensify that act of surrender. For a person like Girishandra Ghosh, just a single event was enough. Not just because of his integrity alone, but because he was giving this power of attorney to Sri Ramakrishna himself. That could be one reason. But Sri Ramakrishna also could make use of that part of his character. And with that, he gave him a new life. So if a person is really sincere and honest to the core, then he can have a change in his life. One question you may ask, what about our inherent accumulated tendencies? Yes, but even then, if you do that, even your mechanical, involuntary actions over which you have no control, which are manifestations of your accumulated tendencies and impressions in previous life, even these actions will be overshadowed by the memory. Well, I have made an offering of everything to God. That's the idea behind. But it again, it is directly in relation to the intensity with which we have surrendered. A Girishandra Ghosh, when he did completely. You know, how do we understand it? Because he said he's a drunkard, he can't remember God's name, so that won't work for him. Now, only a man of the highest sincerity and integrity could talk like that. Normal man will say, all right, tomorrow onwards I shall not, he will say not, and it will have no effect on him. Very often these things do not have effect on our life because we don't take very seriously. At least we don't take as seriously as Girishandra Ghosh took it. Because he took seriously, he said he will not be able to practice it. Practice teetotal Indian, or what we call. He cannot become a Puritan, he said. Sri Ramakrishna asked him not to drink. Sri Ramakrishna asked him to take the name of God. He knew very well that he won't be able to do that. So he openly said it's not possible for him because of his integrity.
So it's a continuous practice.
Continuous practice can intensify and enrich and reinforce this integrity. Of course, that's true.
It's unfortunate, Maharaj. These events and all these things bring a lot of animosity and
difference.
Bring a lot of animosity and differences in conversation and this and that. And we realize that after the fact.
But if every day, if it rises, then we can reduce the. The occasion, we can reduce, we can go on reducing. Every day if you realize, then we can reduce it. That's the idea behind. Girishandra's character is a complex character, you know, because he belonged to a particular category. So many people like Dostoevsky's life, if you see Dostoevsky, people like them, you know, practically in their life there is nothing spiritual. But there was something great about them. Otherwise, how could you write work like Brothers of Karamazov, Grand Inquisitor and all that? A glimpse into the ultimate intuitive spiritual experience you get in their works. Because Such people suddenly start a new chapter in their life and become saints. They have the equipments with them, but it is concealed. The great spiritual personalities like Siddhamangshana happen to help them, it becomes easier. But even otherwise, through constant practice, we can reinforce our own conviction and enrich and bring in more and more integrity. That's it. Isn't it not so? And this Sravana means constant hearing. Manana means introspection, will help us. Let's say Sravana means constant hearing, Manana means introspection. These two together can reinforce our integrity.
So in addition to meditation, contemplation, these ideas, and offering to God and all these things are very important.
I see our mind has come within that realm of that, otherwise you won't be worried about it. We feel the need for spiritual evolution because we have already entered the field. We have already started the spiritual pilgrimage. Otherwise, we won't feel the need for spiritual enlightenment. See? So that means we are already on the track. So if we continue continue hearing, constant hearing and introspection, we can go ahead. Yes. Okay.
Well, as you're speaking of this intensity of determination that we must have, is that what slowly bridges the gap between really living at the mental level to this, as you say, this you can understand intellectually these sublime ideas, but our life is way behind. We live more at the mental level, and it's this intensity of determination that bridges that gap until it reflects in this higher the buddhi.
Yes.
Is that
what is called the constant hearing and introspection, sravana, manana. These constitute our effort to increase integrity and increase intensity. That will certainly bridge the gap between intellect and mind, because when we really start living according to our convictions, then the gap is filled, bridged. Then the gap is bridged. So as we start practicing more and more, then we find the gap gets narrowed more and more.
So, something related to that. So in the three classifications of devotees, you see a psychological as well as an ego transformation happening as you grow from the lowest to the Bhagavatottama. Mm. In the highest stage...
Have to remember, 1 minute. Here in this verse, 1:45, 46, 47, here the description is in an descending order.
Yes.
That you have to keep it
right. You could see the mental and psychological transformation in a person as you go through that. And all of us have gone through that transformation. In the highest stage, it seems to me that it's more of an experience, an intuitive understanding of reality, which is hinted rather than, which is actually beyond what a devotee can grasp, with his faculties. Whereas the other thing seems to be like, hey, a devotee is actually trying to practice some things and he's making an evolution. So I want you to comment on the experience aspects on these three devotees and how that can actually help us move from one stage to the other.
Well, that's why I said there are two levels of evolution. Evolution at the level of the ultimate reality. Evolution at the understanding of goal. No, this is the goal doesn't evolve, our understanding evolves. So accordingly, the devotee also evolves and goes through three levels of evolution. So one could say the 47th verse, the last one, the primitive what is explained in this 47th verse explains a very incomplete understanding of the absolute reality. And the 46th verse explains less incomplete, maybe more complete understanding. And the 45th verse explains a complete and perfect understanding of the absolute reality. The reality is the same. Our level of understanding evolves. And the reality doesn't evolve, our understanding evolves. And according to the evolution of our own understanding, our own spiritual evolution takes place. The one point to remember is, 47th verse describes the characteristics of a devotee of the most primitive type. And 46th verse describes those of a devotee belonging to the middle level. And 45th verse, the first verse that I explained, describes the characteristics of the highest devotee. So the description is in a descending order, from the highest to the lowest. That is the approach, adapted here and also in the Gita 12th chapter.
The reason I wanted to ask you this is that, like in the Madhva Sampradaya or some of the other Sampradayas, which are, you know, you pretty much stay at that level and then, like, you go, you know, at the highest level, which is actually hinted there. What I find is a very big disparity in not reconciling
True.
Other religions.
Yes, yes.
But at the same time, being able to reach the highest. So I don't understand. So that is the reason for my question, that, like, that it seems that, like, as if you're able to, you know, transcend some of these ethical, physical boundaries in an apparent leap towards a superconscious, superconscious reality.
See, philosophical evolution is different from spiritual evolution. You sometimes you find, even among those who do not have a philosophy comparable to this, there are big mystics who have reached a very high level. But even they, in their words, we get the idea they have reached a very higher level of experience, though their philosophy doesn't support it. See, most of the great mystics of Middle Ages, in their writings you can find glimpses of the highest, what we normally call bhakti experience or Advaitic experience, non-dualistic experience. But the religious or theological scriptures do not support that view, because such a system of philosophy did not evolve in the theological tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But at the experience level, see, if you read Eckhart, for example, in Eckhart you find, he says, the knower, the known and knowledge merge into one. Now, though he had to face some opposition, still he belonged to the accepted theological mystical tradition. But in the received theological tradition, his views may not get much support, though he had reached that experience level. That you find. So that's point here to remember. See, philosophy is a very inadequate tool to express higher spiritual mystical experiences. See, philosophy belongs to the Dvaita level. You have to remember, philosophy belongs to the dualistic level, the level of differences and plurality. Philosophy can never be non-dualistic. Even Shankaracharya says non-dualism is a matter of experience only, not of philosophy. There is no such thing as non-dualistic philosophy, he himself says. But then what happens? Non-dualistic philosophical superstructure builds up a philosophical foundation in support of Advaita, but Advaita in reality is a matter of experience. See, Advaita in reality is a matter of experience. So, Srutya, Yuktya, Swanubhutya. Books, scriptures, then logical analysis, then one's own intuitive experience. That's why at the experience level, there is a preferred reconciliation between philosophy and intuitive experience. That's fine. So mystical experience can never be adequately expressed in philosophical vocabulary. It's a very inadequate tool. Philosophy, after all, belongs to language only. Language can never be an effective tool to express experience.
Did any of these philosophers, you know, who have tried with the ideas,
There'll be many. Already. There'll be many. Many. You can find practically in all religious traditions, there have been great men and women who have reached highest mystical experience. I say, you have to remember this. Please remember what I said earlier. In certain religious traditions, their theological superstructure may not support this higher mystical experiences. But in Vedanta, it fully supports and expounds it. That's the idea behind. So, there are many, even in religious traditions which are not so well known, what we normally call primitive religious traditions, there have been great men we do not know. Because mystical experience is a matter of inner human qualities, like integrity, sincerity, inner growth. It is not the result of philosophical structure, superstructure. What I said was, in many religious traditions, though there may not be any theological or logical support for mystical experience, there have been mystics who have gone beyond theology and philosophy.
So, Maharaj, one question that in all of this, you know, where does the grace fit into all of this?
Grace is actually a subject dealt with in devotional literature. Grace. There are two concepts, you know, parallel concepts, not parallel really, grace and human effort. So, at the higher mystical level, there is a reconciliation between grace and human effort. When we stand outside, when we have not started a spiritual journey, we feel there is a gap, there is a difference between grace on the one hand and self-effort on the other. But when we really enter spiritual life, you find they get reconciled. I can explain this in the light of another parable in Sri Ramakrishna's gospel. You find, see, Sri Ramakrishna refers to, in his gospel he refers to this subject. Suppose you want to cross the river and there's a boat tied to the anchor. If you really want to cross the river, you have to untie the anchor, you have to enter the boat, and you have to reach midstream. You may have to row a little, and then you can make use of the wind that is blowing. Now, if you just sit outside, if you sit on the banks of the river and say, "I want to cross the river," you won't be able to do that. So you have to shake off your laziness and lethargy. You have to enter the boat and you have to do some work to take the boat to the midstream. And then only you will be able to make proper use of the breeze, the wind, you know. But another question arises. Who gave you this ability to untie the anchor? The same God whose grace is blowing in the form of wind enabled you to untie the anchor and take the boat midstream. So, but can you distinguish these two? If you just sit on the bank of the river, "I want to cross the river," then wind will not help you, will not be helpful to you. So first you have to do some self-effort, and then you'll be able to make use of the grace. Without self-effort, we will not be able to make proper use of grace. But once you start making use of grace, you understand the self-effort also was possible because of grace. So self-effort merges in grace. Before that, we may think self-effort is one thing, grace another. But if you look back, who gave me the power, the ability to untie the anchor, enter the boat, and do the work necessary to take the boat till the middle of this river? Well, the same God who sent this wind of grace enabled me to shake off my lethargy. So instead of sitting on the bank saying, "I want to cross the river," I untied the anchor and entered the boat and did necessary work. So human effort is part of grace. But this is realized only at the practical level once you enter spiritual journey, not before. So, not only that, if you don't make your own effort, you won't be able to recognize grace as grace. Suppose Sri Ramakrishna or Christ or Buddha or anybody appears before you all of a sudden, you won't realize, you think it's another person who has come to see, attend a retreat. But if you pray with great intensity and integrity, and then if you get an experience, then you will realize, you will be able to appreciate, you will be able to recognize the act of grace. If God suddenly comes to us, we won't recognize Him. We won't do that. So even to be able to recognize God's grace, self-effort is necessary. So self-effort gives us the equipment, the ability to appreciate, understand, and make use of God's grace. I think this explained, as I said earlier, you know, in the complete works of Saint Avila, Saint Teresa of Avila, you find a story mentioned, you know. She uses the analogy of a farmer who is trying to irrigate the land. There is a lot of weeds and grass and undesirable growth. So the farmer first clears the ground, removes the weeds, and there is a river nearby. There is a well, there is a water mill. There are many options for him to bring water to the field. But suppose suddenly it starts raining, it's God's grace. But even to be benefited by rains, you need to do some work. You have to remove the weed. You have to remove the grass. Otherwise, if it starts raining, the grass also will grow. So, to be able to fully understand the real worth of grace, to become grace-worthy, self-effort is necessary. But self-effort also, on a larger plane, is a part of grace. But that fact is recognized at the experience level. That's the idea we had. I think we have already reached the end of time. So, we continue this discussion at 3:30 this afternoon. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa.